from the police. The immigrant grapevine being what it was, the authorities wouldn't think twice about an uncle showing up in the wake of a nephew's having been at a murder scene and having undergone police interrogation. Neither would the police find it unusual that an angry uncle would arrange for his nephew to get out of Paris and away from a bad circle of friends for a while. With a murder and a potential gang war on its hands, the French authorities would need all the manpower they could muster. They'd be glad not to have to waste resources on surveilling the chemist any longer. So Tursunov had taken the second step in helping his chemist disappear. The third step would come tonight. Chapter 51. Palermo, Sicily. Mafioso Carlo Ragusa lived with his wife and five children in a well-fortified home on the outskirts of Palermo. The grounds were patrolled by dogs and plenty of men with guns. Could Harvath, with Gage and Haney out of the fight, have breached the Sicilian compound and gotten to Ragusa? With enough surveillance and planning, he was confident that he could pull anything off. But in their race against the clock, Libya had stolen much more time than it should have. Anxiety was running high back home. In the wake of two deadly terrorist attacks, Americans wanted answers, and Washington wanted results. Both of those wants fell on Harvath's shoulders. There had to be another way to get to Ragusa, and he pressed Lovett, the one with all the Italian connections, to find it. To her credit, she did. A counterterrorism contact of hers in the Carabinieri's Elite Special Operations Unit, known as the Raggruppamento Operativo Speciale, or ROS for short, owed her a favor, a big one. She had allowed him to see intelligence the CIA was building on a suspect who had made multiple trips back and forth between Italy and Tunisia. While he couldn't cite it directly to his bosses, it had been the final piece in the puzzle he needed, and had helped roll up a burgeoning terrorist network outside Turin. The information he shared in return would prove just as useful. Street racing of horses was a brutal and highly illegal sport in Sicily. It brought in over $500 million annually, and Carlo Ragusa was right in the middle of it. The horses were forced to race on asphalt or cobbles. To minimize accidents, roads that sloped uphill were chosen. To minimize the pain of running on such hard surfaces, the nerves in the horse's hooves were surgically severed. Wagers could range from hundreds to thousands of dollars. In the past, angry mobs had stoned losing horses to death. Spectators on scooters and motorbikes, yelling and honking, rode behind the terrified animals, frightening them into running faster. The horses involved in the Palermo races were kept in deplorable conditions in dilapidated garages and storage units throughout the city's old town. The races were normally held at dawn, just as the police shifts were changing. The location was kept secret until the very last moment. When the race was run, the road was closed down, and residents were threatened with violence if they didn't stay indoors. Harvath had no desire to try to snatch Ragusa from such an event. Lovett, though, told him she didn't think it would be necessary anyway. The night before a race, men were known to stay out the entire evening. According to her source, Ragusa used the races as an excuse to see his mistress. She was a tall, beautiful 22-year-old Nigerian named Naya. The mafioso had put her to work as a bartender in one of his clubs in the old town. There, he could keep his eye on her. She lived in an apartment above. The club was called Il Gatto Nero, and no doubt a cretin like Ragusa enjoyed keeping his black mistress at an establishment called the Black Cat.
"Do they have the apartment under surveillance?" Harvath asked.
"My guy says no."
"Do you believe him?"
"I do," she replied.
Harvath nodded, and Lovett continued the briefing. Once it was complete, they returned to her vehicle and went to talk to the team. The men listened, and when Harvath was finished, Stalin asked, "So, what's the plan?"
"I'm still working on it. I'll know more when we get there."
"That's my favorite kind of plan," the Delta Force operative responded. "Count me in." Harvath looked at Barton,
the short, red-bearded SEAL.
I was in as soon as I heard hot bartender, the man replied.
Morrison laughed.
Harvath said hot, tall bartender. Maybe we should bring phone books so you can put them on one of the stools.
Barton feigned that he was about to laugh, then shot the Marine his death stare. Turning to Lovett, Harvath said,
Looks like we're going clubbing.
Leaving the base at Sigonella, there were multiple signs that warned not to transport any weapons off-post.
Oops, Stalin said from the back of the SUV. There's another one I didn't see.
Because of who they were and what their assignment was, all of their security checks had been waived. The weapons they had brought out of Libya had accompanied them to Sicily. They were violating multiple local laws, as well as international agreements with Italy. The Italians didn't care for covert operations being conducted on their soil. If Harvath and his team were caught, there was no doubt that the Italians would vigorously prosecute them. That was an inherent risk in any assignment they conducted abroad. Don't get caught was the unspoken number one rule. The key word in black ops was black for a reason. The drive from Sigonella to Palermo took a little over 2 hours. The medieval Old Town area was a labyrinth of narrow streets and alleyways. It became apparent rather quickly that they were driving the worst kind of vehicle possible. Finding a parking space as close as they could, they then walked the rest of the way in on foot. Their first order of business was to get a look at Il Gatto Nero. But not knowing how they were going to handle things later at the club, Harvath didn't want them seen together in the area in one big group. He instructed them to split up and surveil the club separately. Lovett suggested a local restaurant where they could meet up, eat, and compare notes afterward. They all agreed to rendezvous there in an hour. Harvath moved through the colorful, awning-covered open-air market on the Via Ballaro. Blood oranges, lemons, tomatoes, garlic, lamb, beef, octopus, clams, cuttlefish, capers, olives, and chicory were all artfully displayed on tables in crates, bowls, barrels, as well as atop mountains of ice, and all of it hawked by loud shopkeepers in a cacophony Sicilians called abbagnate. The architecture of the old town was a reflection of Sicily's having been ruled over by many different cultures. Traces of Greek, Roman, Arab, French, and Spanish influences could be seen throughout. Right before the end of the Via Ballaro, he came to the Via Rua Formaggi, took a right, and slowly walked down past the Black Cat. It was housed in a four-story building, the first floor of which was painted a burnt tangerine. It had a black awning, with potted palms in the street, blocking any parking out front. A brown metal gate covered the door. Brown wooden shutters covered what looked to be an expanse of floor-to-ceiling windows that opened up onto the sidewalk. The main entrance to the apartments above appeared to be adjacent to the entrance of the club. If there was a bouncer, which any club worth its salt would have, that was going to be a problem. There was no way they'd get through that door without being seen, not without creating a major distraction. He'd have to come up with another way in. Walking down to the next corner, he turned left and pulled out his phone. He had no problem at all looking like a tourist. It would only help his cover as he continued his surveillance. Opening up Google Maps, he pinpointed his location, then he clicked the satellite view and zoomed in on the neighborhood from overhead. For as many narrow passageways as the old town had, he'd pulled the short straw in this section. Buildings were built side by side and back to back. There were no alleys, no rear exits. There was, however, something interesting. Behind the Black Cat was a group of adjoining buildings surrounding an enormous inner courtyard. Palermo was famous for its palazzos. Harvath figured that's probably what the adjoining buildings originally were, that or a convent. But now, with the concrete of the courtyard painted like a soccer field, he figured it was probably a school of some sort. Along the north side of the complex, the roof was flat and lined with solar panels and hot water tanks.
From there, it was a short scramble to get up onto the roof of the Black Cat building. Harvath decided to take a closer look. Walking up to the Via Giuseppe Mario Puglia, he hung a left. Half a block down, he saw something that made him smile. Scaffolding. The old town was just that, old, and during his short walk through the neighborhood, he had seen a ton of renovation projects. He made a mental note to look into investing in a Sicilian scaffolding company. But as quickly as the thought entered his mind, he got rid of it. If the mafia here was anything like it was back in the U.S., the construction industry was the last place he'd want to put his money. Crossing the street, he held his phone up and pretended to be trying to get a signal. As he did, he took a video of everything he saw. The narrow, cobbled street was quiet. As best he could tell, it was residential. No shops, no cafes. There was very little traffic. It was perfect. He had found his way in. Checking his watch, he saw that he had enough time to search for potential places to reposition their vehicle before he'd have to head back and meet the rest of the team at the restaurant. Chapter 52. Stalin was the first to arrive at the Osteria Ballaro. It was a Sicilian restaurant built in the stables of an old grand palazzo. He had taken a table in back, had his book out, and was reading when everyone else arrived. Harvath noticed he also had a beer in front of him.
"Having a good time?" he asked.
The Delta Force operative looked up from his book and drew Harvath's attention to the rest of the restaurant.
"When in Palermo?"
Harvath looked around. Everyone had a cocktail or a bottle of wine going. He didn't mind drinking. In fact, he enjoyed it. Just not before an operation. That said, his team didn't exactly look like teetotalers. They looked every muscled inch the intense ass-kickers they were. To not have at least one drink on the table would have raised eyebrows. More important, his guys were professionals. They had trained with alcohol in their systems and knew its limiting effects. He decided to allow it. Morrison ordered a beer as well. Barton asked for a glass of Chianti. Harvath and Lovett joined him. As soon as the waiter had left to go get their drinks, they began discussing what they had noticed while surveilling the nightclub. They all agreed that getting up to the apartment unseen via the street entrance was a non-starter. By the time the club opened, there'd be too much going on. That also meant that getting Ragusa out of the apartment in order to interrogate him at another location was out of the question. The interrogation would have to happen there. They assumed that the mafioso would be traveling with bodyguards and could call upon nightclub security for backup if needed. The Black Cat was equidistant between two of the busiest police stations in the town. If a call went out to law enforcement, response time was likely to be fast. The team had done an excellent job of mapping CCTV cameras, potential escape routes, choke points, and alternate rally locations if they were forced to split up. When it came to breaching the apartment itself, they were in agreement with Harvath. They would have to come in from the roof. The waiter delivered their drinks and asked if they were ready to order. Lovett asked him in Italian to give them a few more minutes.
"Show me your shoes," Harvath said after the waiter had left.
"My shoes?" she replied.
He motioned for her to do it, and she complied. Turning in her chair, she slid one of her feet from beneath the table and showed it to him.
"You flew in from Rome. Where's your bag?"
he asked.
"In the back of the truck."
"You have any other shoes in there?"
Lovett nodded.
"My running shoes? Why?"
"Because I don't know if this Ragusa character speaks English. In case he doesn't, you're going to be my terp. You'll go in via the roof with us. Running shoes will do."
"Full disclosure, I'm not very good with heights."
"You'll be fine," he assured her.
"What about the rest of us?" Morrison asked. "How's this all going to break down?"
Taking out his phone, Harvath opened up Google Maps and showed the Force Recon Marine a large Baroque church, the Chiesa del Gesù, a block over from the nightclub. Because it was built on an angle, back from the street, it created an area that opened up extra parking.
"You should be able to park right on the edge," Harvath explained, As long as you don't leave the truck, it won't get towed.
No offense, but why me? Morrison asked.
Because Haney's not here, and I trust you. That's why.
Morrison didn't look convinced.
Listen, Harvath continued. If I'm a Palermo cop and I roll up on you, I'm not going to get a bad vibe. You're obviously an American, and he's probably going to peg you for military. Just smile and tell him you're waiting for a legit spot to open up, so you can join your friends for drinks.
Why not have Barton do it?
Because he's incapable of smiling. Nobody would believe him.
That's true, the SEAL said from across the table, giving Morrison his death stare.
Also, Harvath said, tightening in on the satellite image of the rooftops, I think he's about the right size to go into the apartment via the skylight.
And him? Morrison asked, looking at Stalin.
He's going to be our eyes and ears on the ground.
Waiting a beat, Harvath added,
We all good then?
They all nodded, except for Stalin.
What's up?
Harvath asked. The Delta Force operative slid his phone over to him. On it, a weather app was open. Harvath hadn't thought to check the forecast. That was a mistake. And it was on him. He knew better. Not that it would have made a difference. Their options were what they were. Rain or not, they were going into that apartment, and they were going to get Carlo Ragusa. Chapter 53 Paris. The Le Maurice restaurant was the most beautiful restaurant Turzenov had ever seen. Inspired by the Salon de la Paix at Versailles, it was beyond opulent. Gold coated the moldings, bifurcated the mirrors, and dripped from the crystal chandeliers. Silver coated the chairs, the lamps, and even the serving buffets. But the pièce de résistance was the massive fresco painted on the ceiling. Floating above the dining room, it beckoned patrons into a lush spring landscape, populated with alluring mothers and rosy-cheeked infants. The restaurant's most desirable feature, however, was its view of the Tuileries across the street. He could have watched the events unfold from his balcony, but he preferred to be here. He wanted to bathe in people's immediate reaction. He wanted to immerse himself in it. This would be the closest he had been to any of his bombings ever. His heart was pounding with excitement. He willed himself to be calm. Being seen was not a problem. Being remembered was. As he was dining alone, the concierge had booked him a small table in the corner. With apologies for not being able to place him closer to the window, he explained that the hotel was quite full. Turzenov had smiled, thanked the man, and given him a generous tip. A table near the window would have been excellent, but just being in the restaurant served his needs. Up in his room, he had showered, shaved, and performed his prayers. After a cigarette on the balcony, he had descended to the lobby, where he'd had a ginger ale with lime in the wood-paneled bar as he kept to himself. Then, at the appointed time, he paid his bill and stood up. But instead of going right into the restaurant, he decided to step outside. He wanted to take in the early evening air, to breathe one last breath of Paris before everything changed. His table wasn't going anywhere. Pushing through the revolving door, he descended the short flight of stone steps and walked out onto the pavement. "Taxi, monsieur," a doorman asked politely. Turzenov shook his head. The doorman nodded and shifted his attention to the guests behind him. Across the street was the wrought-iron fencing of the Tuileries with its bright gold points. Through it, he could see and hear the outdoor carnival. It was packed and in full swing, just as he had known it would be. Savoring the air, he took in a deep breath and closed his eyes. The calm before the storm, he thought to himself. Exhaling, he stepped away from the front of the hotel, lit a cigarette, and had a quick smoke. When he was done, he returned inside. As he was shown to his table, the dining room looked like a sea of ornate ships under crisp white linen sails. The maître d'hôtel asked if he cared for a cocktail. Blaming jet lag, Turzenov ordered an espresso. With an understanding smile, the man disappeared to place his order.
For dinner, Cherzanov began with scallops from Normandy and chose silk-grain veal with smoked eel and olives for his main course. He had his eyes on the iced chestnut delight for dessert. In his mind's eye, he envisioned the men preparing to martyr themselves. He envisioned how they had spent their last day, ritually cleansing and preparing themselves to enter paradise. They would have read from the Quran, finding courage, comfort, and strength within its passages. They would approach from different directions, their large soccer jerseys concealing the vests they wore beneath. Each man would carry a soccer ball. Cleated shoes would be worn over a shoulder or around the neck. As they entered the garden, they would make their way to their appointed areas, guaranteeing that the force of their explosions and the tsunamis of shrapnel would be spread as widely and as efficiently as possible. Turning his mind back to his food, he decided that the scallops had been quite good, but they were nothing compared to his first bite of veal. It was like an exquisitely flavored butter that melted in his mouth. He had never eaten like this before. Never. For a moment, he forgot where he was. Trimming another piece of the delicately cooked meat, he raised the fork and opened his mouth. But the second bite of veal never made it to his lips. Outside, there was an intense explosion. Its blast wave shattered the restaurant windows and covered many diners in glass. Cherzanov was spared only by virtue of having been seated away from them, farther back in the restaurant. Some patrons had been knocked to the floor. Those who were not were now up and running for the door. Many of them were screaming. None of them could have known for sure what had happened, but instinct had taken over. Get away from the danger. Cherzanov himself didn't know what had happened. It was too early and the blast too close. Either Abdul had changed the attack or one of the martyrs had chosen to go early. Perhaps he had been confronted by police or by French security services. The one thing he did know was that he couldn't sit at his table pretending nothing had happened. Calmly, he stood and followed the other patrons out of the dining room. In the lobby, curious guests were pressing up against the windows and pushing through the doors to get outside in order to figure out what had happened. Cherzanov headed for the stairwell. He took the stairs two and three at a time, hoping to get to his room and out onto the balcony before anything else happened. Halfway there, he heard a second explosion, followed by a third and a fourth. All of the martyrs were detonating now. It was the protocol. Even if one went early, they were to get to their targets and detonate immediately. Taking a deep breath at his landing, he opened the stairwell door, stepped out into the hallway, and walked calmly toward his room. Once inside, he rushed to the balcony, threw open his still intact French doors, and stepped outside. As he looked out over the slaughter and destruction below, he excitedly repeated one phrase under his breath.
Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar.
Chapter 54. CIA Headquarters, Langley, Virginia.
I got here as quickly as I could, said Lydia Ryan,
as she entered the director's wood-paneled conference room. She had always been in awe of this space. It had a tremendous amount of history, not the least of which being that this was the room where the Bin Laden raid had been run. All of the monitors were tuned to live feeds from Paris. A group was seated at the end of the long conference table. Several rolling suitcases were lined up against the wall. The director waved her over.
"We're sending over a team?"
she asked, as she removed a laptop from her briefcase. "FBI, too," McGee replied. "They're going to need all the help they can get." He then turned to a young analyst and said, "Bring Deputy Director Ryan up to speed." The young man nodded and, picking up a remote, stated,
"We got this video from French intelligence 20 minutes ago. It was shot by one of their people just after the bombs went off. I've got to warn you, it's bad."
All bombing aftermaths were bad, especially when civilians were involved. Either this person was new or this really was on a different level. Taking a breath, she signaled for him to roll the footage. As soon as the video started, she realized he had not been exaggerating.
amidst helicopters hovering overhead and the klaxons of emergency vehicles rushing to the scene, all you could hear were people screaming. The sound was horrible, like animals being slaughtered. The images were even worse. Victims' limbs had been sheared off. Bodies lay missing heads. Torsos had been torn open, their internal organs spilling out. There was blood absolutely everywhere. As the French intelligence officer walked his camera through the carnage, Ryan noticed people at the conference table turn their eyes away. They had already viewed the video. She tried to steel herself for whatever was coming up. In addition to ripping through people, the bombs had ripped through the carnival stalls. The destruction was unlike anything she had ever seen. But these weren't the scenes her colleagues couldn't bear to watch. As soon as she saw the smoldering carousel, she knew what was coming. Ryan was reminded of how ISIS had attempted to detonate a suicide bomber inside Kidsville, the children and family camp at Burning Man. Even though one bomber had detonated in another part of the festival, stopping the Kidsville attack had been considered the greatest win of the operation. But seeing what she saw now, none of that mattered anymore. The tiny bodies lay everywhere. Their injuries were just as horrific as the adults, but they were even more heart-wrenching due to their age. The bomber had struck inside the part of the carnival geared toward the youngest attendees. Mixed with the wreckage of the carousel animals were actual ponies, some barely alive and still tethered to the rigging that allowed children to ride them in circles. Their screams of pain, mixed with those of parents and children, were unbearable. A police officer could be seen approaching one of the animals and drawing his pistol, only to be stopped by a colleague for fear of creating a panic that a shooter was loose somewhere. The French intelligence officer seemed to have ice in his veins as he proceeded calmly through the rest of the carnival, documenting everything he could. But when he reached the end, when there was nothing more to document, the phone dropped from his hand, and the man could be heard throwing up. The analyst paused the video there.
"Why don't we take 10 minutes, Director McGee said. "I'd like to speak with the deputy director alone."
As the attendees pushed back from the table and filed out of the room, he picked up the remote and turned off the monitors. Once the last person had exited and the door had shut behind them, he turned to Ryan and said, "The death toll is going to exceed Spain." She shook her head at the grim news.
"How many Americans?"
"We've got our people at the embassy working on it. We know of 18 already, but we expect the number to go higher."
"Suicide bombers? Or were the explosives planted?"
"We're digging into the surrounding CCTV footage," said McGee. "But the working hypothesis right now is suicide bombers. At least 6. One appears to have gone off prematurely, and the rest followed not long after."
"Why do we think one went off prematurely?"
"Because it happened on the edge of the carnival, not inside, where the explosion would have done much more damage. French police reportedly approached a man in a soccer jersey shortly before the first explosion. We're trying to run that down."
"What can I do to help?" she asked.
"Get Harvath to move faster. Whatever it takes, I don't care."
"I'll reach out to him. In the meantime, what about my request?"
McGee leaned back in his chair, closed his eyes, and pinched the bridge of his nose.
"Access to the Malice program."
"It's a big ask. I under..."
"Especially right now."
"I understand. But the more Reed and I have discussed this, the more concerned I've become. Somebody might be trying to smother us in the crib."
The director didn't respond.
"The whole idea," Ryan continued, "is for us to assemble a lifeboat for the agency. If there are people out there attempting to drill holes in it, we have to know."
He thought about it for a moment before replying.
"If I agreed, how would it play out?"
Ryan had wargamed it as best as she could. Her plan wasn't perfect, but she felt she had come up with a pretty good idea. Remaining as brief as possible, she laid it out for him. McGee let it all sink in. It was a big ask, and it involved a lot of risk for the CIA. If it went sideways, even the president wouldn't be able to save them.
Point by point, he went through his concerns, and point by point, she addressed them. Finally, he only had one question left. How are you going to get him in without anyone seeing him? Looking over at the suitcases along the wall, she replied, I think I have an idea. Chapter 55. Palermo. Within minutes of the Paris attack, everyone's phones started going off in the restaurant. As the notification chimes rang, Harvath called a waiter over and paid their bill. He wanted to get to a television. Their waiter suggested an Irish bar a few blocks away. Entering the pub, they saw the TV sets were tuned to several English-language stations, including CNN and BBC. The team ordered coffee and energy drinks. They had a lot to get done this evening, and things had just taken an even more serious turn. The men were not shy about how they felt, not even with Lovett in their midst. Fucking cocksuckers, Morrison growled as he watched the bloody footage from the Tuileries. There were already preliminary reports coming through of how many dead and wounded, as well as the victims' countries of origin. France, Germany, Japan, the United States, Mexico. The crawl on the bottom of the screen seemed to just keep going.
Religion of peace, my ass, said Barton, all but convinced he knew who and what was behind the attack.
Stalin and Harvath both watched the footage in silence, studying it for clues. Same group as Spain? The Delta Force operative wondered aloud after several moments.
And Burning Man, Harvath replied quietly.
Were we supposed to stop this? Harvath nodded solemnly. It was why they had been put on the trail of the dead ISIS chemist. It had taken them first to Libya, and now Italy. The attacks were connected. He was sure of it. They went back to watching the TVs in silence. Everyone in the bar was in a state of shock. No one could speak. There was genuine fear in every single face. Harvath knew what they were thinking. How long until attacks like this start happening in Italy? The barman, a red-headed transplant from Dublin, named Kerry, was pouring complimentary shots of Irish whiskey. He wanted everyone in the pub to raise their glasses out of respect for the dead and wounded. Harvath politely declined, explaining his team had to compete in the morning. Kerry didn't ask in what. Instead, he retrieved 5 Red Bulls from the cooler and handed them to him. When the time came, the team raised their drinks along with everyone else in the pub, as the barman led them in a quick farewell to the deceased and a prayer for those who remained. Harvath didn't think the attack in Paris would change Carlo Ragusa's plans, but he raised the subject with Lovett anyway.
Mount Etna could erupt tonight, she stated, referencing the volcano on the east coast of the island, and this horse race would still go in the morning.
Then we'd better get started.
Lovett's contact had emailed her a picture of Naya, the Nigerian bartender at the Black Cat, and once more, she showed it around. After going over the plan one last time, Harvath organized the team into waves. As Morrison's job was to reposition the SUV, he sent him first. His instructions were simple: go in, sit at the bar, and send a text as to whether Naya was working. Because their radios were so bulky, there was no way they could hide them under their street clothes. They were lucky enough simply to conceal their pistols. If Ragusa was coming to see his mistress this evening, Harvath figured it would happen in one of two ways. Either the mafioso would spend the bulk of his evening at home with his wife and family before heading out, or he would get to his mistress's apartment early and expect her to cook for him. With the little he knew about Sicilians, he doubted Ragusa was going to trade his wife's cooking for his Nigerian mistress's. Plus, there was no way he was going to take Naya out to dinner. That wasn't how men in the Cosa Nostra operated. It was likely a very closely held secret that he was seeing the bartender. Harvath assumed that Naya would work her shift until Ragusa showed up. Once he arrived, or let her know he was on the way, she'd punch out and head upstairs. 15 minutes later, they had their answer. Harvath read the text aloud.
Naya and another woman tending bar. Club less than half full. Music sucks.
Remind him to smile, Barton said.
How's the mood? Asked Stalin. Any TVs on in there?
Ignoring Barton, Harvath texted back Stalin's question.
No TVs, came the response.
Harvath read it aloud.
Good, Stalin replied. We want everybody having a real good time.
Let's just hope it's loud, Harvath remarked.
Don't worry, the Delta Force operative stated. It's an Italian nightclub. It'll be plenty loud.
Harvath then looked at Barton.
You're up.
Don't forget to smile, Stalin added, as the SEAL headed out.
Walking away, Barton gave him the finger over his shoulder.
He's sweet, the Delta Force operative said, as he took a sip of his Red Bull.
Harvath texted Morrison to let him know Barton was inbound. Then, turning to Lovett, he said,
Time to go.
Standing up, he looked at Stalin, who was eyeing two attractive young women who had just entered the pub.
See you there? He asked.
Yeah, the man replied, taking a beat longer than Harvath would have liked. See you there.
Shaking his head, he gestured for Lovett to go first and then followed her out the door. As soon as they stepped outside, he caught the look on her face.
Don't worry, he said. He'll be there.
That's not what I'm worried about, she answered. He was about to respond when he felt the first drops of rain begin to fall.
Chapter 56. The rain wasn't bad at first, but then it started to come down hard. Harvath and Lovett took refuge in a nearby doorway. Based on what they had seen on the radar, it didn't look as if it would hang around for long. Lovett got back to what had been bugging her when they were on their way out of the pub.
Have you figured out what you're going to do with Ragusa if he doesn't want to talk?
Don't worry, Harvath replied. He'll talk.
But what if he doesn't?
We'll burn that bridge when we come to it.
Was that supposed to be a joke? She wondered. This was serious.
If anything happens to him, she stated, I'm the one who's going to get a call from the Carabinieri.
Harvath appreciated the spot she was in, but he didn't really care. They had a job to do. They were going to get the information out of Ragusa no matter what.
How long have you been in Italy? He asked.
Almost 2 years. And before you say anything, I'd actually like to finish out my time here. I'd also like to be able to continue my career and have a nice long retirement without a red notice from Interpol hanging over my head.
This was exactly what was wrong with the CIA, and it pissed him off.
There were probably a lot of people at Burning Man and in Spain and Paris also hoping for long retirements with plenty of travel.
Ouch, she replied.
Harvath didn't respond.
Listen, she continued, I didn't mean it to sound...
The rain's letting up, he said, stepping out of the doorway. Let's move.
They walked in silence back to the repositioned SUV. As Lovett pulled her running shoes from her bag and put them on, Harvath texted Barton and Stalin. Naya was still behind the bar, and Stalin was en route to take Barton's place. Once she had changed her shoes, they headed off for the street behind the Black Cat, via Giuseppe Mario Puglia. Lovett had wanted to clear the air. When they stopped at the corner and Harvath pretended he was checking his messages while he checked out the street, she spoke.
I want you to know that I'm committed to this assignment. I understand what's at stake.
Good,
he replied, scanning for anything out of the ordinary.
I also want you to know that I've worked very hard to get where I am. I don't want it blown needlessly.
That got his attention.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means you've got a reputation. You're known for being a cowboy. A lot of china gets broken when you're around.
And?
I like my job, she said. I'm good at it. I'd like to keep it.
That makes two of us, he responded,
as he tucked his phone back in his pocket and turned to walk down the street.
Just do what I say, and you'll be fine.
They did two passes of the building with the scaffolding in front. A very long time ago, it had been a school. Now it was being renovated into apartments. There were bars over the lower windows and heavy wooden doors on the ground floor.
Why can't we go in through one of these? She asked, nodding at one.
Lever locks,
Harvath replied, pointing at the hardware.
I don't have the right tools. Even if I did, they take too long to pick.
Lovett looked up at the scaffolding and resigned herself to the fact that she was going to have to climb.
It's wet, so be careful,
said Harvath. She nodded. The scaffolding was wrapped in gray plastic netting to make it less of an eyesore. Combined with the dimly lit street, it would help hide their ascent. Orange plastic webbing had been wrapped around the base, ostensibly to keep people from doing exactly what they were about to do. When Harvath was sure no one was watching, he untied a portion of it and climbed inside. Filled with trepidation, Lovett followed. There were no ladders and no stairs. They had to scale the scaffolding itself. As soon as she started, her heart began to pound, and she began to perspire. She reminded herself not to look down. A few narrow boards pushed up against the facade marked each floor. They bowed under their combined weight as Harvath tried to wrench open the metal shutters, all of which had been locked from the inside of the building. The only windows without shutters were on the very top floor. The farther up they climbed, the more her muscles felt like hardening cement. It was getting tougher to get handholds as her fingers froze in mid-clench. She was dizzy, and her legs felt as if they were made of lead.
Almost there, Harvath reassured her. You got this.
Lovett wasn't so sure. Her pace slowed even more. She hated being a slave to her fear, but she couldn't help it.
I can't, she finally admitted. Can't what? I can't climb any higher. Stay right there, he whispered. I'm coming back down.
Beneath them in the street, they could hear the hum of a motor scooter approaching. Harvath waited for it to pass and then climbed down to her. Slowly, he helped her descend to the last set of boards she had been on.
Wait here, he said.
Where are you going?
Don't worry. I'll be back.
And with that, he began climbing upward again. Standing on the wobbly boards, she gripped the metal pipes of the scaffolding as hard as she could and pressed her face against the cool stone of the building's facade. She stood there for what felt like forever before she heard a noise to her right. It sounded like a bolt being pulled, followed by the grating of metal on metal. Opening her eyes, she saw a shutter had been opened. Standing on the other side of the window was Harvath.
Give me your hand, he said, as he reached out for her.
She took his hand, and he helped her climb inside the musty old building. Chapter 57. Once they were safely inside, Harvath took out his phone and texted Barton. A couple of seconds later, he received a response. Barton was on his way. Lovett sat on a stack of tiles and tried to catch her breath.
You going to be okay? Harvath asked.
She nodded.
Good. I'm going to take a look at the courtyard and back. Wait here.
She nodded and watched as he exited the room and disappeared into the darkness out in the hallway. Using the low beam of his flashlight so as not to give away his presence in the building, he navigated to the rear stairwell. On the second floor, he came to a steel fire door and, first making sure it wasn't actively alarmed, inched it open and stepped outside. He was on the flat roof at the north end of the complex. An 8-foot-high wall ran along it, separating it from the building next door. Hopping up onto one of two hot water tanks, he peered over the edge. It was a straight drop, 2 stories down. They were going to have to go to the end of the flat roof and then scramble up and over another roof system to get to Naya's apartment atop the Black Cat. Climbing down from the hot water tank, he retraced his steps back inside and rejoined Lovett. Seconds later, Barton appeared at the window.
Knock, knock, he whispered.
Harvath offered him a hand and helped him climb through. Once the seal was in, Harvath looked at Lovett.
Ready to move?
Her mouth was dry and her stomach was still in knots, but the dizziness had passed and her heart rate had come down. Nodding, she stood up and followed Harvath out of the room. Barton brought up the rear. The trio proceeded to the staircase and down to the second floor,
When they reached the steel door, Harvath texted Stalin for a final sit-rep before they exited.
Naya is still behind the bar, he texted back. Music is plenty loud. You're good to go.
Harvath shared the message with Barton and Lovett, opened the door, and led them outside. At the end of the flat roof, they squeezed past a set of solar panels and reached another pair of hot water tanks. Turning to Lovett, he said,
I'm going to go first, and you're going to come right behind me, okay? Keep your eyes on me the entire time. Don't look at anything else. You're going to be great.
She forced a smile, and when Barton flashed him the thumbs up, he began his climb. Leaping onto the hot water tanks, he then pulled himself up onto the roof of the building next to the Black Cat. It wasn't terribly steep, but it was covered with curved, terracotta tiles. They were very hard to walk on. Now slick from the rain, they were even more difficult. Harvath waited for Lovett to climb up onto the water tank, and then held out his hand to help her onto the roof. As soon as Barton had joined them, Harvath began walking. He chose his steps very carefully. They were three stories above the street. One wrong move, and it would all be over. Once you started sliding, there wasn't anything to stop you from going over the edge. He walked near the roof's seam, testing each tile with only part of his weight before fully committing. Every couple of steps, he looked over his shoulder to see how Lovett was doing. Though the fear was etched across her face, she kept moving. So did Harvath. He was only 15 feet away from the end of the roof when he heard a tile crack and break away behind him. He turned, just in time to see not Lovett, but Barton lose his footing and go down. Before he could get even two steps, Lovett had dropped to her stomach, reached out her hand, and grabbed him. Her rescue, though, was short-lived, as he began sliding toward the edge and pulling her with him. Barton was just too heavy, and the roof too wet to stop it from happening. Harvath moved as fast as he could. He could hear Lovett grunting under the strain of trying to hold on to him.
Don't let go, Harvath ordered her.
I can't hold him.
Harvath picked up his pace, and as he did, he slipped and almost went down.
I'm losing him.
Feet away, Harvath lunged, just as Lovett lost her grip. He came down hard on the tiles, and there was a slap as his hand wrapped around the seal's wrist. Slowly, he helped pull Barton back up. Had Lovett not done what she had, Barton would have gone over the edge. She had saved his life.
Thank you, he said to her,
and then turning to Harvath, he also offered his thanks.
You're welcome. We'll talk about starting you on a diet tomorrow. Right now, we've got to get to that apartment.
Roger that, he said, as he raised himself onto his feet.
Lovett did the same and flashed Harvath the thumbs up. The fear he had seen in her face moments ago was gone. In its place was a determination to finish this task and get off the rooftops. Taking up the lead, Harvath began walking again and gave them the signal to follow. Cautiously, they fell into step behind him. Chapter 58. At the end of the roof was another wall. Scaling it, they were able to get onto the roof of Naya's apartment. The bartender lived on the fourth and very top floor of the building. The challenge now was getting inside. She had a small balcony off the back, but an awning obscured most of it. With a much steeper roof and drop-offs on both sides, only as an absolute last resort would they try to jump down onto it. And even then, trying to do it in the dark would only up the risk. That's why Harvath had wanted to use the skylight.
It's locked, Barton said when they finally reached it.
Harvath wasn't surprised. There was a lot of crime in Palermo.
Let me take a look,
he responded, pulling out his flashlight. The skylight was over the bathroom, and it was a piece of junk. Whoever had constructed it had used wired glass. One of the biggest myths on the planet was that wire made it stronger, and therefore better for security purposes. In fact, the opposite was true. The inclusion of wire actually weakened the glass. It was good in fire situations, but that was it. The skylight was old and in lousy shape. Pushing on it, he could feel it give. The wood around it was soft and rotten. Pulling out his knife, he tried to wedge it underneath without any luck. They desperately needed to get off the rooftop and into the apartment. Motioning Barton and Lovett to move back, he put his knife back in his pocket and took out his pistol. Turning it in his hand, he drew his arm back and smashed the weapon into the skylight. The entire pane of wired glass not only shattered, but fell out of the frame and crashed into the bathroom below. Harvath raked the moldy edges of the skylight opening to make sure no glass or pieces of wire had been left behind, and then got into position to cover Barton as he made the entry. It was an easy drop, only about 5 feet. Barton had aimed to land on the toilet. He hit his target, but there was just one problem. The lid was as cheap as the skylight. One of his boots ended up punching right through and into the bowl. Harvath had never seen the seal move so fast. His foot had barely touched the water before he leapt up almost straight out of the skylight. "Fuck," Barton whispered, as he simultaneously pulled his pistol and tried to shake the water off his boot. Stepping over to the bathroom door, he peered into the apartment and then signaled for Lovett and Harvath to come down. Even on the top floor, they could hear the dance music throbbing from the club downstairs. The apartment smelled like cigarettes and cheap perfume. Quickly, they cleared the rest of the rooms, and confident no one was home, they cleaned up the glass in the bathroom and began to get everything they needed pulled together. 45 minutes later, Harvath's phone vibrated with a message from Stalin. Naya had received a text and was now divvying up tips with the other bartender. When she handed her register drawer to one of the managers, Stalin pinged him again and told Harvath to expect company. Because of the music, they couldn't hear any movement coming up the stairs, but soon enough, there was the unmistakable sound of a key in the lock. When the door opened, Naya stepped inside. She was very tall and very pretty. She closed and locked the door behind her, then pulled off her boots and tossed them in the corner. Next, she pulled off her top and threw it through her open bedroom door onto the bed. She did the same with her skirt. She wasn't wearing a bra or panties. Walking naked into her bathroom, she reached behind the curtain and started the shower. At the sink, she squeezed some toothpaste onto her toothbrush and began brushing her teeth. It was then, as she looked in the mirror, that she noticed the hole in the roof above the toilet behind her. Instantly, she spun around, and when she did, she saw the woman at her bathroom door with a gun pointed at her.
"Be calm," Lovett told her in Italian. "We're not here for you. Do everything we say, and nothing bad will happen."
Chapter 59. Securing Naya in the bedroom, they dimmed the lights and got ready. Lovett had read the text on the bartender's phone and knew that Ragusa would be there shortly. Half an hour later, Harvath received a message from Stalin. "He just pulled up. Two bodyguards with him. Get ready." Harvath relayed the information to his team, and everyone got into position. Naya had informed Lovett that Ragusa always came upstairs alone. His men would either wait in the car, have a drink in the bar, or stand at the front door and chat with the bouncer until it was time to leave. It sounded plausible, but all the same, Harvath didn't trust her. Yet whether the mobster came to the door by himself or with his two goons didn't matter. The team would be ready. According to the bartender, Ragusa had his own key to her apartment. He expected her to be in bed naked and waiting for him when he arrived, so that's where they had put her. And though Harvath was glad to have the cover of the loud music from downstairs, he hated not being able to judge how many people were headed toward them by noise from the staircase. The seconds dragged into minutes. Finally, Harvath's phone vibrated again. "Goon 1 just sat down at the bar," Stalin texted. "Goon 2 is talking with the bouncer. Target is unaccompanied. All yours." Harvath passed it along. Moments later, they heard Ragusa's key in the lock. They had no idea how many times the mafioso had been to the apartment to see the young Nigerian bartender, but enough that he had a routine.
And if he had a routine, especially one that involved leaving his security downstairs, he hadn't arrived expecting trouble. Anything but, in fact. Ragusa had come expecting a good time with his mistress. After this visit, he was going to take his security very seriously. That was, if Harvath let him live. He had been racking his brain, trying to come up with a way so that there'd be no blowback for Lovett. But so far, he hadn't been able to come up with anything. Depending on what information they got out of the mobster, they might not be able to let him go. The last thing Harvath wanted was for him to report back to ISIS that he'd been interrogated by an American team. Even worse, that the team was interested in knowing the destination of a Tunisian chemistry student who had drowned while being smuggled across the Mediterranean Sea. The only way to keep him quiet would be to kill him, or ghost him to a black site facility like the Solarium back on Malta. Either way, once he went missing, Lovett was going to be on the short list of suspects. Her anti-terror contact at the Carabinieri would be all over her. That wasn't Harvath's problem, though. Working at the CIA meant you had to be willing to take risks. It wasn't about covering your ass and hanging on for 20 years until you could collect a pension. The closer you got to the tip of America's spear, the more dangerous things became. As far as Harvath was concerned, the only measure that mattered was whether you did everything within your power to achieve the mission you had been sent to perform. Right now, everything revolved around Ragusa and his interrogation. How cooperative, or uncooperative, he was, and what kind of information they got out of him would dictate what they would do next. As he watched the knob turn, Harvath's whole body tensed. He couldn't wait to get his hands on Ragusa. The only other group he hated as much as terrorists were mobsters. This was one interrogation he was going to take extreme pleasure in. The door began to open, and as it did, he could feel Ragusa on the other side. A thick, menacing energy radiated from him. Harvath was so preoccupied with it that he almost didn't notice.